Campus FM presents the Benjamin Tonna Lecture 2011, organized by the Institute for Research on the Science of Times. This talk is delivered by Professor Christoph Zanussi.
Your Excellency, Dr. Ben Gadami, Mr. Speaker, ladies and gentlemen. In line with our mission, the CERN have been trying hard to do some research and organize lectures which help us for a collective discernment of the signs of the times. And one of the signs of the times is definitely not only the change which is happening, because change has always happened and evolutionary change was constant in human history, but the rapidity with which this change is happening and the harm which it can cause, not because it is bad or good, but because human beings, as Emil Durkheim tells us, find it difficult to adapt very quickly to new norms which are and values which change so quickly. So it seems that if we are, even if we are not under attack, even if it is the most positive form of new culture, we seem to be constantly under some form of attack. And to talk to us on this type of attack, we have Christoph Zanussi, who is an academic and an artist. I think he prefers being called an artist, which he is, in fact. He's a great film director from Warsaw. And I'm sure that Father Benjamin Tonna, to whom we dedicate this lecture, would have been happy because his father and himself, besides being an academic, he was also an artist. The curriculum of Professor Zanussi is very long. He studied at the University of Warsaw and also at the most famous Polish university. He studied philosophy at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. He is director of the film of the Polish film studio Tor, and has received several prizes and awards, included Davide Donatello in Italy, the Cavalier Cross of Polonia Restituta Order, and the Cavalier de l'Ordre des Sciences et Lettres. Besides this, I was ignorant and I didn't list it in his biography, which I gave you. He is also a member of the Pontifical Commission for Culture. So we are in a very good company. You might pass a good word to the Pope for us. The list of films is enormous, which he has produced, with different titles. Perhaps the most famous is his film Illumination, but there are others. I am not a filmographer myself, so I'm not an expert in this field. He's got also a good film, which is very relevant, which is called Our God's Brother, which deals with modern-day problems. Without much more ado, I'd like to introduce to you Professor Zanussi. Thank you very much.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I feel very honored by your kind invitation, and I feel also slightly intimidated by the presence of so many distinguished guests. I have a credit, university credit. I'm professor and my credits are long. I've been lecturing at Columbia, at Cambridge, in Moscow, at the Sorbonne, but only as an artist. So please don't confuse me with a real academic. I'm not. And I'm allowed to talk nonsense sometimes. And this is a great privilege of an artist. I wanted to talk to you about the new barbarians. I like this concept and I would like to propagate it. And altogether, it will be at least halfway optimistic lecture. However, barbarians make a very bad association we remember that once Roman Empire was falling apart because of the barbarians. We remember Romulus Augustus and Odoacer, and we remember the end of this beautiful, incredible upheaval of our civilization, antiquity. And this has all fallen apart because of the barbarians who crossed the Alps and took over old Roman Empire. So, when we read Boethius, we see all the despair of a witness who can see the decline of culture, of morale, of intellect, and physical decline of the beautiful empire. Sometimes we suffer something similar today. We also feel that something is deteriorating. Boethius complains about Latin becoming more and more vulgar. And we complain that our languages, that our art, our lifestyle becomes more barbaric every year. Especially when we talk about mass media, when we see the image of our civilization on the screen of our TV sets or our theaters. When I think about the broadcasting standards of BBC of the 50s or 60s, I quote BBC because you're English-speaking audience, I would say the same would apply to French or Italian television. This television was promoting high culture, was broadcasting operas and dramas, and if it was shooting something, it was shooting films based on the classics. And this was a process of popularizing the high culture. In fact, I use this distinction, and maybe somebody will feel that I'm not modern, but I definitely do not subscribe to postmodern view that there is no high and low culture. In opposite, I strongly believe culture may be high and low. Low culture, by courtesy, we call today popular culture, but it's just a polite expression. Nobody likes to be called low, however many deserve. When you see today in most European countries, TV programs, Big Brother, vulgarity, primitivism, TV serials that totally destroy the greatest achievement of our civilization in the field of narrative art, that is the legacy of Greek tragedy, of Greek drama. This banal soap opera form is chopping life into small pieces of no means whatsoever. They are meaningless. So nothing is decisive. While Greek tragedy, unlike other dramas, unlike Sanskrit drama, unlike Arab narrative patterns, in our tradition, we had this vision of life which has knots, which has turning points, and the rest, well, the rest was the silence, as Shakespeare said in Hamlet. So we knew that this is a vision of life when we feel that some moments are decisive. When you watch today soap operas and serials, you have totally opposite impression. Nothing is important, nothing has meaning, everything is chopped like meat in fast food restaurant. And this is decline. Definitely, once the level of mass communication in Europe was much more sophisticated, today it is trying to reach the lowest common denominator to get highest ratings, because television is selling products. Well, we all know it. We see it on other fields. If you compare leading European papers 30 years ago and today, Times of London, what a decline today. Corriere della Sera, you cannot compare it, what it used to be and what it is now. Süddeutsche Zeitung, and so on and so on. In order to be well sold, you must go low with the level. Let us go back and look for some consolation when we think about fall of Roman Empire. After a couple of dark ages, from 6th till 12th century, there was an amazing upheaval with the Crusades and construction of universities, with Gothic cathedrals and music of the time. Barbarians became civilized and started to create incredibly rich and profound medieval culture and great construction of mind called scholastics. And all that happened only a couple of centuries after the fall and was very largely spread over much bigger territory than territory of Roman Empire, old Roman Empire. So the barbarian invasion lasted long, but finally brought some benefit. And, of course, Illuminists distorted the image of Dark Ages, confusing the epoch. They wanted scholastics to be expression of Dark Ages, and that's totally wrong to my understanding. But since then, since time of 12th century, we have permanent growth and development, and our civilization is getting better and better. There is no doubt about it that the living standards are growing, everything seems to be changing into better. So the first barbarian invasion was absolutely beneficiary for humanity, if we look from this perspective. Lalo, let me tell you something of my own personal experience. You know, artists is often thrown into politics in public life. I admire it because I never take it seriously, as no politician takes me seriously, so we have a very natural relationship. When Mr. Gorbachev was the president of the Soviet Union, he paid a visit to Poland, and Poland was still communist, so it was a totalitarian regime. However, totalitarian regime by the end of the 80s tried to be more civilized. And as Mr. Reagan at that time was visiting Moscow, and he insisted and met Russian dissidents, Mr. Gorbachev decided he wants to meet Polish dissidents to show he is equal. And I was one of the invited. And I was called to take the floor and say something. I knew it was televised, and I knew it was going to Russia. I didn't want to do any harm to Mr. Gorbachev, because I knew that his policy will bring us one day or another to freedom. But from another hand, I wanted to point out that I don't belong to to supporters of his ideology. He was a communist. And I had a moment of hesitation, and from the back of my mind, I picked up an idea which I probably read in one of the papers, or I don't know where. We all have ready ideas somewhere stored in our brain. I told Mr. Gorbachev that among many competing civilizations of the world, the Chinese, Egyptian, Indian, only one, Aztec, Mayan before, only one, our Judeo-Christian civilization brought such an incredible progress and growth. No other did it. Egyptian Empire lasted for thousands of years, and the life of the son was the same as life of his father and his grandfather. There was a minimal change. There was very little change in China and in India. And only our civilization gave us this acceleration. And from 12th century on, it was getting better and better. And it is not by coincidence, because I think that Judeo-Christian inspiration gave anthropological basis, because human being was recognized as God's son. So it was a great nobilitation of our creativity, of our freedom, of our dignity. No other religion gave such an advantage to the human being. So, to conclude my little speech to Mr. Gorbachev, which was more maybe as long as this one now, I told him, if Soviet Union today is facing so many problems, technological, economical, social, maybe it is because it went too far away from Judeo-Christian roots of our civilization. This was my point to say I don't belong to his orientation. In fact, later on, everything has fallen apart. I met him a couple of times later. Obviously, he didn't remember me, but I asked my prime minister in Poland, who walked him around Old City after this meeting in 1987, and the only question that Gorbachev had was, and this filmmaker, is he a Jew because he doesn't look like one? It was because I spoke about the Judeo-Christian, what in Orthodox tradition is not a common expression. So, from one hand, achievements of our civilization are incredible, and I think today we tend to underestimate them, and that's a great mistake. I think it is almost criminal not to respect enormous progress we have done. We keep forgetting that in the past we were, great majority was living miserable life, poverty, hunger, danger. It was, well, I cannot talk about cold weather because it's not your case, but it was my case in Northern Europe. People were starving, people were freezing, people were killed on the street, and this all is over, and is over only recently. Practically in 19th century, it all finished. And when we look back to Charles Dickens, to Emile Zola, we see the description of the tremendous sacrifice that previous generations have made to make our life so rich and so easy as it is now. And it gave us so much freedom, which can be measured. I don't talk straight about political freedom. I'm an ex-physicist, so for me, the more convincing measurement of human freedom is energy. How many calories we burn every day? How many calories I burned today because I've been flown from Warsaw? A ton of kerosene was burned to have me here. No Roman emperor could afford such a fast and comfortable travel. So we are really lucky, and I think we don't appreciate it enough. But from another hand, we talk about new barbarians. And I think this is very easy to define. New barbarians are our local people. It is an interior invasion, not from behind the Alps. We have no Germanic tribes. We have our own proletarians, who are now getting to this society and creating a middle class universally. This is a great change, and Ortega y Gasset was writing about it, anticipating how far it will go. And of course his assessment was very right, but very negative. I would like to see the positive aspect of it. It is, for the first time in the history of humanity, more than half or more than 50% of population of developed countries has now decent life. In the past, it was a slight minority that had decent life, and all the rest had miserable life. So we have to remember how much we have achieved. Our memory is very selective. Because look, what we remember, let us say, in the field of arts, because that's close to my heart. Look at time of Haydn or Mozart. They were writing marvelous music. It is one of the peaks of high culture. But for whom did they work? For a prince? For emperor? For a bishop? And their audience was probably smaller than my audience today. Probably 50 people in the salon, not more than that. It was enough. And let us make this silly remark. Think about the power of acquisition that prince, emperor, or pope had. He could have paid Mozart an enormous amount of money, and Mozart was rich. While at the same time, you had pop music. There was a pop music, popular music, and in some inns, in some common places, some people were singing and dancing, and they were collecting some peanuts, and they were poor, because the power of acquisition of the mass audience was minimal, and power of acquisition of upper class was enormous. And at the same time, taste and money went together. They were married. They happened to divorce in 20th century only. But up to 20th century, it would be inconceivable for a pope to be, or for a bishop, or for a prince to be ignorant in the matter of arts, or music, or painting, or literature. It would be inconceivable to be ignorant, because it went with his status. I've just come across a survey of Danish sociologists of Indian origin, Surjit Palam, who defines middle class in a very approximate way, saying whoever is able to save something like one-third of the daily income for some purpose would be considered as a middle class. And according to this criterion, which is arbitrary, of course, you have today in United Kingdom 72% of people who would be white-collar middle class. And at the same time in India, it is approaching to 20% our days. It seems to be that in China it's even more. But this is growing very fast. Now, if we look at this change today, what happened? The new barbarians means our new brothers who were promoted from misery to relative wealth. They got a very big power of acquisition. They can buy, they can pay, and they promote culture, which is accessible to them, which is easy and pleasant, and we would call it still primitive, but it is a noticeable industry that is producing it. So, definitely, today's mass culture is far inferior to what high culture used to be. And at the same time, old elites are losing the power of acquisition. The educated, cultivated people are unable now to pay art on the level that they will require. So we need a state to subsidize high art, and with democracy and populism, it is slowly becoming more and more difficult. Look at opera, lyrical opera in Italy. It is relatively popular, more popular in Italy than in any other country of the world. However, out of the taxpayers' pocket, enormous amount of money is given to opera, and only very few can enjoy the seat in opera. So people are more and more rebellious. Why should we pay for it? If they are unable, opera lovers, to pay what the opera singers demand, and opera singers are less paid than pop singers today. So, finally, this will be again problem, and one more populist will say, finish with these subsidies, we don't need them. Well, it was a remark about the change which we all witness, but I would like to notice some other important factors in our development. Europe was developing in a way harmoniously in spite of all the wars we had, and I think only 20th century, based on reason, brought us to the real catastrophe. It was catastrophe of reason, two great ideologies that have been criminal ideologies, which have been born on presumption that Nietzsche pronounced in 19th century, God is dead. Since God is dead, we have other gods, and we have National-Socialism of Hitler and International Socialism of Lenin and some other peripheric totalitarisms in Italy and Portugal and Spain. And this was definitely the biggest catastrophe of the process of development of Europe. And as in my country, I suffered it particularly much. Both totalitarisms left dramatic signs in our life. I know that this is something to regret and to ask, why did we fail? Why this subtle, evolved European culture brought us to such a catastrophe? Well, now let me talk a moment about a simple fact which I already mentioned, quality and quantity. When I see the society of developed countries today, including my own country that develops very fast, I see that the access to education is far bigger than ever in history, that the access to culture is much bigger than ever, also due to technology. People listen to the music even excessively, I think they listen too much. They can read as much as they wish, and they read more than ever in the past. They read tabloids. Tabloids are regrettable papers, but they are read by people who never read any paper whatsoever. So maybe that's a progress. Even tabloid is better than illiteracy. People watch idiotic television, but they learn something that they haven't known before when they were living in their village, isolated from the world and having knowledge limited to their very close circle. So with all these elements, the mass culture, the low culture, is a very positive effect and should be welcomed by people who were attached to the principal values. Because you see that these values, in maybe cheapest form, are accessible to many. So this is a new factor, and people learn, and I think they grow. So maybe the moment of this confusion today is only temporary. It will change very soon. Look at such a small example, food. In the past, simple people were happy when they were able to have enough calories. They couldn't allow themselves to be capricious, to have choices. They were happy when there was something to eat, because humanity was hungry. Upper class was well fed and immediately developed certain restrictions and limitations. It was not allowed to eat, at least in my family, to eat between meals, and it was not allowed to eat excessively. Now, in mass society, starting with the United States, obesity is a great social problem. 50% of Americans are obese because they haven't inherited a restriction. They don't know that if you have enough, you don't take it all. And that's why they become fat. And that's a question of culture, not of medicine. It is just a question that they have no culture that forces them to limit what is accessible. We have lots of such basic changes in modern society in the last 50 years, that there is abundance of food, but there is also another change which has enormous impact on culture. It is relationship to sex. Since conception has been introduced and made available to whole society, the whole culture of sexual relationship has changed. In history, for many reasons, sociologists are better in defining why people were afraid of procreating bastards, what consequences it had for family life, for the survival, for the feeding of the next generation. So there was some restricted order imposed on sexual life, and women had to be very thoughtful about entering into intercourse to avoid pregnancy. This is gone, and sexual life banalized. So when we look back now on 19th century, life of the greatest poets, it was usually love disappointment that was behind the greatest achievements of human talent. It was usually some sort of frustration that brought people to so many inventions. Now, sexual instinct may be easily satisfied already in the secondary school. So there is no tension. And some feminists insist that men should be more effeminized, and that women should be more masculine. So at the end, we will have unisex society with no sexual attraction whatsoever. I am rather afraid of that. However, I want to make a distinction, and this is my own invention. I try to compare feminism to cholesterol. There is a good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. So definitely there is good feminism and bad feminism. I quoted the bad one, but the good one is existing, and I will subscribe to it. So modern society is free of these basic preoccupations of the past. How to survive? In a developed society, it is almost impossible to die of hunger. I don't want to be cynical, some people die of hunger, but mostly because they have been neglected, not noticed by somebody. But usually, in all developed countries, somebody will come with help and some food will be given. So this has vanished. We will have place to survive when we have when temperature is low, and sex became banal, so it is not a real problem. However, with all these elements that has changed, something new must emerge, because we lost some balance as humanity, I'm afraid. We will face some major problems with the survival of our species. And that's what is, to me, interesting and very, disturbing. When I look on decline of mass media television, I will quote another rather exclusive experience I had. I was honored to entertain Prince of Wales during his visit in the 1990s to Poland. And it was a time of his separation with Lady Diana, and he was followed by all possible televisions of the world looking for sensation. And together with the Prince, we have seen on television in British Embassy, in private, of report of his visit on CNN or maybe some other chain. I don't want to incriminate them, but it was made the same day. And this report, this broadcast, was openly suggesting that Prince Charles is looking for a sex affair with his lady bodyguard, who was with him in the trip. And I must say, we were all deeply embarrassed. The editing of the material was strongly suggesting this. It was not enough to make a cause, because they are shrewd and clever. However, it was giving the public a great explanation. Why did he make a trip to Poland? He made a trip to Poland to get to the very muscular lady who was his bodyguard. Totally idiotic. I spent a couple of hours with Prince Wales. I know what his agenda was. It was least probable scenario. And Prince of Wales was kind enough to ask me, Mr. Zanussi, you are a scriptwriter. Would you put such a story to your script? And I said, no, by no means. My sense of realism tells me this is not likely to happen. And of course he said, I'm not a sex maniac, and however my life is not exemplary, this is making out of me a total idiot. And he made a beautiful remark, that's why I quoted. He said, why at the time when public was so uneducated, Shakespeare was writing about my ancestors, many of them real criminals, but he was writing text which is meaningful even today because it is true to life. It is looking for deeper truth. And why I today, at a time when most of the public has higher or middle education, when there are no illiterate viewers of television, my life is presented as a soap opera, totally unrealistic, idiotic, scandalous. I wonder, because that's true, that the audience of Shakespeare was often very simple. But this audience was bound to look for truth and sense. And audience today, in this very fortunate time of history, may effort to be frivolous, to tolerate stupidity. And this is something, what I would say, is a new factor. This factor has only now emerged. And I'm very upset about it. My education was different, but my education is old-fashioned. I am 71, so I belong to the very old generation. And I remember my father, who was telling me, he was definitely formed before World War I and World War II. But when something, when a book was declared to be bestseller, he was saying, let us give it to the maid or to a driver or throw it to the garbage. It was inconceivable to read a bestseller. If general public has low taste, and we know it has, why should we read it? If it sells well, it cannot be good. And it is not good. If something is a bestseller, it cannot be a good literature. We know it even now. However, my grandmother was even more surprised because she has heard that father says, give it to the maid. And she said, do maids read our days? Because when she was young, maid was always illiterate, so there was no market to write trash literature for this public, because this public was not reading anyway. So the basis of the public has enlarged. And of course it is better to read trash than not to read anything. But from another hand, however, this is doubtful assertion, but this has changed dramatically, and we are under enormous pressure of mass audience and mass public believing that they if they are many, they are right. And from the other hand, I will blame our well-being for frivolity of our culture and of our problems. And this is something what I see depicted, reflected in culture very strongly. Public today tends to duck all existential and basic questions about our existence, about sense, about God. We have substitute problems. I think they are substitute. We talk about tolerance. Tolerance is a nice thing, but very, I would say, very modest. It is not a real great value. Because when you talk about culture, tolerance is included. If you have good manners and if you have good feelings to people, you don't need to talk about tolerance. You have it for granted. But I have an experience, which is my private experience. I have 9 dogs, most of them Labradors. All these dogs are naturally selected to hunt for birds. And they bring me hens from the neighborhood. I have to pay to the owners. And unfortunately, with the use of the cane, I try to teach my Labradors tolerance. I have a success. I don't need to eat broth of chicken anymore because my Labradors leave hens alone. So they are tolerant. But I will never be able to teach them love to chicken. Here, come is not enough. And in our heritage of culture, in Christian tradition, we have love as an ultimate criterion of our humanity. So we have to treat with love other people, and tolerance will come out naturally. There is no reason to talk about it so much as it is told today, especially because tolerance is applied to the, I would say, gray sphere, because good things don't need to be tolerated. They are embraced and welcome anyway. Bad things should not be tolerated. So only something what is between is a subject of tolerance. So it's too much to me, too much noise about something what is in fact not substantial. We talk a lot about minorities. It is important we have to treat other people well as we treat everybody. Again, culture covers it without any specification. But when I see very frivolous people insisting about all kind of marriages that should be legally allowed, leaves me totally indifferent. I don't mind people of other sexual orientation living together and let them call it one kind of contract or another. But I have my own private idea as an artist. The real problem are not homosexuals, who are very few in the society. Why does not society, it will be a nonsense now, why does not society allow people to have a contract with themselves? So many people are so egoistic that they love themselves only. Let them make a contract and avoid taxes as long as they love themselves only and nobody else. The same with euthanasia, which is one of these frivolous concepts that if nothing is sacred, why life should be sacred? It is not sacred. If it is not sacred, it may be taken away. We have great thinkers like Australian philosopher Mr. Singer, who keeps saying that people who are mentally defected should be treated as animals, not less humans, because there is nothing human. Strange that after experience of Nazi, still this idea is re-emerging. I'm usually trying to ridiculize it, saying, euthanasia, if so, why, first let us start with abortion. Why abortion only allowed till 12th week? Let us allow abortion up to the 9th month, because there is no major difference. And after 9 months, why this limit? Isn't it more logical to say that abortion is allowed up to 18 years old, and then euthanasia is a natural consequence? So if you don't kill your children, your children have right to kill you. And that would be a real logical construction. These popular debates are usually based on some vacuum of values and on total misunderstanding. And they are taken seriously. So I try to ridiculize it and say, no, this is not serious. But from another hand, I see that Christianity in Europe is shrinking, is less present in public life, and in our Pontifical Commission for Culture, Cardinal of Westminster brought this very intelligent idea that Christians should, once we become minoritarians in culture, we should treat it as an anti-culture. We should go as all other anti-cultures go, be in minority and consider yourself a minority and consider yourself a seed in a hostile environment, hoping that something will grow. I wonder why such an amazing suggestion that John Paul II left in one of his less known documents, letter he directed to the director of the Pontifical Astronomical Observatory, Specola di Vaticano. In this letter from the late 90s, just before Fides et Ratio, John Paul II suggested that if in times of Thomas Aquinas, theology was using all the instrumentarium, all the instruments of contemporary science, why theologians today ignore totally what modern physics and mathematics is offering? To what extent these models that mathematics and physics is offering could be helpful to understand the gospel, which was formulated in the language of 2,000 years ago? If you think about matrix, if you think about parallel universe, if you think about the theory of strings, you know that the eternal life, contact with the dead, purgatory, all these concepts may be seen in a more convincing light. And only that, because it is not an explanation, no science will ever explain the message of the Bible, but it can be used to make our fantasy work in a more modern way. I strongly deplore that we don't do it enough. There are very few theologians who are aware what contemporary science is building. And, well, time to conclude. I hope very much that mass audience, with its low culture, will create some new avant-garde or new elite. We don't like the word elite because it has bad connotations, incorrectly. But at the same time, if Christianity shrinks, I have this vision. I've been lecturing recently in China, and I've seen these audiences of Chinese students, and I've heard their questions, and I know they are bound to win in a short or even in a long term. They are growing so fast, they are learning so hard, they are working so hard, they are fighting so hard to have better life, that compared to the lazy Europeans and Americans nowadays, comparing to the families that don't want to have children, they are bound to win. In fact, talking to the rector of the one of the Cantonese universities, I tried to have at least one consolation, so I asked him, how is it with the capacity of inventing? Don't you think that we Europeans may be of some use in future? Oh, he says, absolutely. Because we, with our heritage of Confucianism and tradition, we are not inventive at all. He said, in my experience, said the rector, when I have 10 European students, one of them is able to invent something. When I have in China 100 students, one of them only will invent something. But when we look at the numbers, we are more than 100, more than you. So we will have more inventions in the last few years than you have in old Europe and America together. That scared me a lot. And then I realized that maybe the next generation our grandchildren, hope maybe grand-grandchildren, will all migrate to China, hoping that they will be allowed to be babysitters and clean some apartments. It won't be easy because Chinese don't like our scent. Unfortunately, we smell bad to the Asians. But if they tolerate that, we will have little jobs, and maybe like 12 apostles, the only mission we will have will be to bring Christianity to China and give them a chance to develop into more rich and creative society. That would be my strong wish. And I think the clock has just, the watch has rang, so I think it is time for me to conclude. I think it is expected that we will have questions, so of course I am ready to answer if I didn't bore you to such extent that there will be no question whatsoever.
Thank you very much, Professor Zanussi. And now,
a film I shot 40 years ago, and I took the same actors to play the same role today, asking a question that probably all of us in a certain age always ask. It is the question, is our life accomplished? Is our life fulfilled? What we did wrong in the past? Where was the mistake? And I thought it would be interesting to take my characters from a film I have shot 40 years ago, a slightly autobiographical film, when I was showing the decline of my world, of the world of the ex-upper class, totally degraded under communism. And of course I thought this is over forever. Now I see we are back to normality, and some elements of the old cultures are back, and also some people are getting their property back. So something that Hegel would say is irreversible, became totally irreversible. So maybe that would be of some interest, mostly because there is a passage of time which is rather unique. That's why this film is shown in many countries as something very special, because without any makeup job, you may see the same people 40 years ago and now, what happened to them. Of course, they are characters, fictitious, they are actors acting, but this passage of time is something what film made possible only recently. 40 years ago, it was the time when film was becoming in color and technology was more or less the same as today, but even 50 years ago it was different. So I wonder if there are no questions and if there is any patience, maybe we can watch something like 10 minutes of the film. Is it a good idea? If so, I have the film here. It is with subtitles. I'm sorry, this film I shot in Polish, but subtitles are in English, so I think they will be easy to read, if this works.
Would it be pessimistic nowadays?
No, I'm not pessimistic. I still hope that not everything is lost. So that's a very optimistic view. The film is called The Revisited. It was shown at Rome Film Festival a year ago. And I shot it for my 70th anniversary, thinking this is the time to make some sort of a balance of my own life and of the life of my characters that I have created. You know, creating characters makes you feel very strange, because sometimes characters become autonomous. And when you write a play, I write sometimes for theater, when you write a script, and I write all my scripts, sometimes I feel that my characters are rebellious, and I write not what I wanted, but what I feel is right, which is not necessarily what is my intention. And that's a very strange feeling. I think God has given us a unique opportunity to participate in his creative act, giving us a little chance to create our own stories, worlds, characters, and fiction. Fiction is accumulation of the experience of the past. Our progress is based on the experience that we have accumulated from previous generations, from the situations we haven't lived in. That's why narrative art is to me so important for the development of humanity.
Thank you very much, Professor Zunzi, for your beautiful lecture and nice presentation. And of course, what we've heard today doesn't necessarily bring to mind the way François Lyotard describes the contemporary situation of the world, and which he calls the postmodern condition, whose central concept is that anything goes. And the origin of this society is basically American pragmatism, which has been, American philosophical pragmatism, which has been exported as quickly as Coca-Cola. And so today, knowledge is CNNization, and nutrition is McDonaldization. So what is appreciated today is not beauty, justice, but popularity. I hope that it will give us time to reflect on what Professor Zanussi tells us, so that we will be able to turn the page from new barbarianism. Lyotard said that postmodernism means the fall of the Enlightenment project. Not everything in the Enlightenment was okay, but we have much still to learn from the Enlightenment. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Institute for Research on the Science of Times, entitled The New Barbarians. This talk was delivered by Professor Christoph Zanussi.